I've been called an impresario, a poseur, a fashionista, a raconteur, a thief, a self-publicist, an inspiration, a fox. It's all true. My name is Malcolm McLaren, and this is a program about London. Blame it on London. My London. A soundtrack for the city. It's a map of memories, of feelings that derive from living in this city.
This is London.
London, for me, is a city that created the look of music that inspired my life and times. It also helped create the sound of fashion, something I've been obsessed with. It's a noisy, hungry and irreverent place, and at times, I don't know how you could consider London quiet, cautious and even forgiving. This stony-hearted place has parks, believe it or not, heaths, commons, woods that appear to be welcome breathing spaces. These places bind together what was once villages. Villages that make up this city known as London. Sometimes when I see London from far away, in posters or on the television, it appears this sort of solid grey stone city, a place you should admire for its history and pageantry, with its little Enid Blyton red-painted buses, Buckingham Palace with the changing of the guard. It's a ridiculous, silly postcard of a city for tourists.
Good morning and welcome to a rather damp and dismal London. The Lord Mayor arrives at the Mansion House where he'll watch the parade.
Most cities have a gender. Rome is male. New York is young and equally male. Berlin, hard, exotic, strange, and deeply male. Paris, a wedding cake, female. London, everybody looks upon London and scratches their head because it's somewhere, strangely enough, in the middle. In fact, I don't think it knows what it is. Sometimes it's male and female all at once, a hermaphrodite. It's a city whose sex constantly changes.
Tonight, London is a city of song and celebration and thanksgiving. There are fireworks and parties. Many words have been spoken and much drink has been consumed. London has been somewhat hysterical and still is. The organized killing has ended in Europe. The young men of many nations have suffered, sacrificed, and achieved victory. The coming months and years will reveal what will be done with that victory.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise.
I grew up in Stoke Newington, a village in North London, a place that had its own world and history. I lived with a tyrannical grandmother, a woman who spoke in English and pidgin, French and Portuguese. Here in a house on Highbury New Park, she never tired of telling us stories. My brother and I had to stay up late. I on a pot from the age of 5 at 10 p.m. would listen constantly to my grandmother talking to her sisters about the Great War, about her friend, the housekeeper of Agatha Christie, about her surrogate child, Marjorie Proops, who became an agony aunt for the Daily Mirror. Her world was a world filled with theatrical people, a world of tradesmen who came to the house to sell us something. In summer, the strawberries lasted 5 days, chestnuts in the autumn, and then the onion cellar from Brittany. My grandmother's laundry arrived by horse and cart every Thursday. I waited, looking through the letter flap in the door.
Too came that great luxury of pre-war times, clotted cream. And for the first time for 11 years, strawberries reached their appointed end again in good company.
London in the 1950s was bomb-struck, black, crumbling, dark, miserable, strange place.
Some Whitsun to remember. Not only 3 days of holiday, but for thousands also the extra thrill of saying again, fill her up. White petrol and
bomb sites were everywhere. I can recall climbing and scaling and scrambling over ruins, picking up pieces of old newspapers, broken pots, stuff that were like relics from a distant past. In the evening, you could hear animals, owls hooting, nightingales. Church Street, Clissold Park. We would walk the territory, my grandmother said, of Edgar Allan Poe. Sometimes I dreamed we were following him, an old man shuffling along in a thick coat. Deep into that darkness, peering long, I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. Years of love have been forgot in the hatred of a minute. There was Defoe Road, next to Defoe School. I believed Daniel Defoe had built it.
Thank you, and here's our last turn for tonight. We meet once again, the long and the short of it, in those Cockney kids, Ethel Revnell and Gracie West.
My grandmother was a stage door Johnny. I followed her.
Short and long, long and short, but it means the best. The long one's Ethel Revnell.
And the short one's Gracie West.
Holding onto her coattails from shop to shop, restaurant to restaurant, pub to pub, musical to musical.
We're two little maids looking somewhat quaint. May appear to be what we ain't. Never judge a sausage by its skin. You can't tell what is in within. Oh, we do see life. Yes, we do see life. Though we haven't got a magic.
Waited for my grandmother through afternoons at Collins Music Hall on Islington Green. Standing dutifully next to the newspaper stand where the man hollered,
"Dog news and standard!"
I knew at some point my grandmother would reappear. Her world had not been eclipsed by rock and roll. The back room at the Horseshoe Pub on Tottenham Court Road was where she would tell us tales of Abraham Goldsmith, the original Fagin. He never died, Malcolm. He was merely transported to Australia, and there he became a famous entrepreneur, responsible for building some of the most beautiful houses in Sydney. She told me to watch out for my mother.
She's mad, you know. She doesn't understand. I did once get her a job in a famous department store on Piccadilly called Swan and Edgar. A job as a window dresser. But all she did was look out at everybody from those windows.
She was constantly derogatory towards my mother, who I saw less of. She was a commercial traveller selling her gowns to various department stores up and down the country.
We pick out an awesome avatar each way. Oh, we do see light.
Yes, we do.
So there you have it, Malcolm. Your mother is man-mad. This was London of the 1940s and 50s, gangland. London then was ruled by kids under the age of 21. Why? Well, as my grandmother told it, those very kids were too young to go to war, and they were left on the streets, and it took over what was better known as London's underworld. It was a world of contraband. It was a world of stolen property. It was a world that led to gigantic robberies.
We'd like to see the cargo, Captain. Could you have the hatches open for us?
Yes, sir. I'll record my noise.
And then we'd like to see the crew. If you would muster them on deck and allow them to pass through here one by one with their books.
All right, sir. I will tell the officer.
And London was carved up by these teenage Jews in those early post-war years. There were tales of gangland shootings by teenagers on Charlotte Street. Smash and grab, a new form of crime. You were always confronted on every street corner by a nattily dressed kid, better known as a spiv. He was your man. They all became my grandmother's friend. Whatever you wanted, you just had to ask. A side of smoked salmon for someone's engagement. A wedding dress, perhaps, Mrs. Corey. A new set of bone china. Whatever you want, my darling. My darling. My darling. Charlotte Street, Clerkenwell, Shepherdsbury, West Ham, Whitechapel, Soho were all now driven and governed by teenagers, treating it as the spoils of war. Lingerie from France, horsehair sofas, bentwood chairs. You could purchase a sideboard, a Cadillac car, gold ring, the most expensive imported beluga caviar. Sharp suits, sharp boots, pimps, hookers, everybody used the local spiv. They were never going to give this back to the older, true underground gangsters before the war. It was a different world, a world ruled by gangs that later became the entrepreneurs of rock and roll. Under the arm. This one doesn't know if it's male or female. This one's got no spine. Bends like a gay boy. This one's ancient. Roman. Heroic. A wine for the boy. This one's virginal. Needs to open up a bit. And this one has the taste of noble rot. I first understood sex, age 16. I was leaving school at the dawn of the 60s when my mother took me to the labour exchange to find me a job. There we listened to the roll of vacancies. Making electronic parts in a factory in Ealing, a trainee chef, a biro assembler in Hackney, a bank. My mother was listening out for glamour, for something grand, and then it came. Here, we have a job requiring someone to train as a wine taster. Will you have to travel? She asked. Well, quite likely. It's a company called Sandemans. Very well-known port and sherry merchants. You might need to visit their vineyards. You know, port. You never know. She was inspired. He'll take it. Sandemans in Piccadilly. A narrow alleyway and a rickety old staircase. I was greeted with a bellow from huge, red-faced walrus.
Over here, boy. What's your name?
We shuffled into a room where small test tubes were laid out, filled with ruby red, yellow, gold and pink liquids. Blindfolded and taught by this old, somewhat colonel figure about wine. His version of sex, but our rites of passage.
Is virginal. Pommard, that's for the French. Tastes of filthy, bitter earth. Not for us English. Gevrey Chambertin, fat under the arm. Hermitage, heroic. A wine that's truly masculine.
They were the remains of a crumbling past, an empire that was being dismantled. Years spent in Asia, some outpost in Java or Borneo. Out on Civvy Street, this old colonel loved to drink. He conjured battles, fields of fighting, blood, guns, smoke, earth, barricades, and explosions. The wine was either a battlefield or a woman. A woman who had, as he said, seen it all. A woman as if an army had been through her. Or a virginal girl. Or someone who didn't know where to lean to. He had sex with them all.
What do you think, McLaren?
At lunchtime, we marched behind him along Piccadilly, down the side of Leicester Square, to a place in Orange Street for eel pie, mashed potatoes and liquid peas. By evening, having drunk port from 11 to 1 to 3, regardless of having spat out Burgundies, Rhones, Bordeaux wines, I was drunk as a skunk, slumped asleep on the train. I often missed my stop.
Sometimes the city is too much. There are too many people, too many cars, too many houses, too many streets, too many smells, too many noises, too many people. Then it's time to take a rest from the city. Leave the people, escape from the state of mind.
Parks are places of refuge, places to rest your feet, places where people are not trying to sell you something, places where you can just simply look up at the stars through the leaves, contemplate. I come here, lie down under a tree and gaze up. Cove on Orange Street, I gave the colonel the slip. I was mesmerized by two girls who walked past in moss green mohair sweaters and black fishnet stockings. I couldn't stop myself following them up the Charing Cross Road and watched as they entered a large building. My heart was racing as I followed them up the stairs and peered through the glass door at those very girls sitting around a naked woman draped in velvet. I was blown away. What was this place? As I looked into the window, I saw this orange and pink huge placard spelling out the letters St. Martin's School of Art. Goldsmith, Chelsea, Harrow, Croydon. I went to them all. At Harrow, I remember this art teacher. If any of you are here to be successful, well, forget it. You're not going to be bloody successful. What you're all going to be is failures. Well, failure, come on, it's not so bad, you know. Helps take the pillow off your head in the morning. So, you're still bloody here then. I guess you must have learnt something about failure, but don't think you can just fail. No, what you've got to do is learn how to fail magnificently, brilliantly. For it's better to be a flamboyant failure than any kind of benign success. Most people, when given the choice between a garbage disposal unit and falling in love, will choose a new garbage disposal unit.
The lights blaze and dance, a city with her makeup on, and in the side streets that crisscross their devious ways behind the arteries of light, and in the alleys where the lamps are low, the clubs and the easy money joints, the fashionable night spots as proud of their respectability as a girl of her first mink, the all-night cafes and the nude shows. Soho. Life after dark with an enamel gloss and the cracks showing. Garish, gay, avaricious, and a little sleazy at the edges.
I walked through Soho with red hair, but everything below my neck was black. Wandering into all the clubs, Les Enfants Terribles, Le Saint-Germain-des-Prés, Le Kilt, La Poubelle, Le Macabre, La Bastille. They were everywhere. In the darkness of Le Macabre, you drank coffee, sitting on a coffin with skull lamps with a candle inside, and I saw a man sitting next to a beautiful girl. He wasn't looking at her. He was asleep. The ash was almost touching his fingers. And we all looked and thought, that's who I want to be. That's where I want to be. I want to be just like that. Dark, black, the color of boredom, of nihilism, the color that we all wanted to be part of. This new existentialist feeling blowing across the channel. The only problem was I had red hair.
There's no quicker way to travel than on the tube. The large underground railway network that lies beneath London.
After midnight, when the tubes had stopped, we simply ducked under the railings at Baker Street and followed the tube tracks all the way to the suburbs. Finchley Road, Dollis Hill, Wembley Park, Preston Road, Harrow on the Hill, and finally the suburban streets of West Ruislip. One John Betjeman-type house after another, these semi-half-timbered, 30s-looking houses, duplicated for miles and miles and miles, were suddenly lit up by this giant, huge American base.
Though they all work on the base, they don't all live there. There's only enough room for some of the unmarried servicemen, and many of the others have semi-detached villas in quiet little suburban streets where they join the Smiths and the Joneses and the commuting city clerks at the end of the day.
And there in the midst of it stood the PX store, a haven of Americana, a place where you could purchase this culture in the form of Levi jeans, Lucky Strike cigarettes, and 45 RPM rock and roll records.
Got a crazy little cat that works downtown and cuts an awful lot of capers when I come around. She's out the westbound diesel with the evening mail in a room. Red blue jeans and a pony's tail. She can do more tricks to this heart of mine. The 10 little mothers on a long way to find. I know when she holds me while I get so weak and pale. It's a loony. Red blue jeans and a pony tail. Rock!
Get it! Go! Lucky Strike. They had this brilliant emblem on them that featured so heavily in our minds because it was the dawn of pop art. It was the imagery associated with Andy Warhol, Jasper Johns. We could buy packets, hundreds, 200s. We could buy records, Levi jeans. We all wanted American culture. We prayed at that altar. It was the real thing. It was an authenticity that we desired. It was part of our new world. During my student days, I saw Jean-Luc Godard interviewed
by a famous English film critic who asked the question, Monsieur Godard, who is your favourite filmmaker? Roger Vadim, he said. Roger Vadim had directed And God Created Woman, and it was in this movie that we all fell in love with Brigitte Bardot. There was a gasp from the film critic. And he said in a pompous fashion, not Eisenstein, not Melnau, but Monsieur Godard, why? Vadim. Jean-Luc Godard simply responded, Roger Vadim is the greatest amateur. She can make cold chills run up and down my spine. Let me feel warm in the wintertime. So packs an awful lot of wallet to be so small and fair in a room. We, on the other hand, had another idea about life. And this was the life that would force me, ultimately, to abandon home. There, on the top of Harrow on the Hill, I would live in a cemetery and gaze out over London, just as Byron once did. It was the summer, it wasn't cold. I could sleep in this graveyard and now be aware that I was on a different mission, a mission that would change life, my life, and everyone else around me. I had to embark on this journey. Failure had become my mission. How to become a flamboyant failure. I'm barely 20, I'm living in a squat in Clapham. It's a free for all, you might say. There's my friend Gordon here, and there are these American escapees who've dodged the Vietnam War and instead are selling LSD in sugar cubes. The fridge is simply full of them. Will I take these? Will I become a flamboyant failure? I debated these thoughts constantly with Gordon, and one night his sister arrives. She's run away from her husband. We're introduced. Her name's Vivian. Feign sick, fall into bed with her, and under the covers lose my virginity. And at the same time, I can hear my grandmother. No money for you if you live with girls. Don't trust girls. I'm not going to give you any money if you start living with girls. Months pass and Vivian is pregnant. My grandmother gives me £200. £100 for her to go and see a doctor on Harley Street. And here's another £100. You shall buy her a present. And on the threshold of this clinic, you must give her the present. I didn't carry out my grandmother's wishes. Instead, I pocketed that £100, and upon the threshold of the clinic the following week, Vivian decided just to take the money that I'd given her for the abortion and instead buy a cashmere twin set on Old Bond Street. Our child was born. I named him Joe. My grandmother surrendered to the fact that she lost me. I'd crossed a line,
and I was out of her reach, and she was never to speak to me again. Years of love have been forgot in the hatred of a minute. Underground on the underground in the 1960s. We're outlaws. We're riding tube trains. We're moving up and down the carriages, wearing clothes that reveal who we are, or who we think we are. Everything's on the outside. It's our identity, album covers, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones. We needed to announce ourselves this way. A Penguin paperback stuffed in a pocket. Thomas De Quincey's Diaries of an Opium Eater would peer out often of little leather jackets as they cruised the carriages on the underground. Graham Greene, jeans and biker boots, the stuff of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, or The Naked Lunch by William Burroughs, or that English dandy head-to-toe in velvet who loved Keats, Byron, and Shelley. We were disenfranchised art students, combing the streets for objects, treasure, relics, vestiges of my past that I love, music of the 1950s, cardboard boxes full of stuff. We didn't know what to do with all this memorabilia. A spiv, a thief? I must become a professional thief. I must raid the art school library. Thousands of collectible books in there. I spent night after night steaming off labels, and marched to Charing Cross Road into Mr. Jackson's shop, a man who wore a dressing gown all day, smoking old Holborn in the corner of his mouth, pretending he never knew where this loot of old books came from. When they discovered I was the library thief, I acted quickly. I removed all the evidence. I burned the place down. Looking and gazing at a record cover of Elvis Presley, I decided I was going to make myself the most beautiful blue lamé suit. I purchased the fabric down on Berwick Street Market in a shop that I knew called Borovic's.
The market's already open.
A tenner for this lot, 15, 20. Thank you, sir. Here you are, love, fresh this morning.
Women weave their way in among the baskets and the barrows, tough cockney bundles of thick clothing.
Spent days with Vivian stitching this beautiful blue lamé suit. It was November, gloomy as hell, as I woke up that morning and told Vivian I'm going to walk down the King's Road and hope someone will notice me, take me, exploit me, use me, abuse me, whatever. Wanted to lose myself in the King's Road.
There was a strange walking man, leaving footsteps on my lawn. He cried, I can't understand. My love left just before the dawn.
Music is pouring out the more demi-monde of the King's Road, the darker, the more bohemian, the more rock and roll, the more decadent part of the street, the places where antique clothing was sold, the places where you could find brothel creepers from the 1950s, the places that sold velvet loon pans to the likes of the Rolling Stones, the Faces, Led Zeppelin. Somebody, somewhere, is possible to see me. Why not?
Is that the shadow I see? Why does his face escape me? Where is the strange walking man? Now I'm a strange walking man. And if my sorrow now seems bad, I'm a strange walking man.
I'm getting tired and it looks like it's about to rain. And as I turn the bend that leads to World's End, I could hear the thunder. I was about to get drowned in my blue lame suit. And making a dash for the phone box, I was suddenly confronted out of nowhere by a man dressed in black with a pompadour hairstyle. A Mephistelian creature ran across the street and speaking with an American accent. He was the real deal.
What are you doing around here?
I've got stuff to sell. Stuff. Lots of stuff. He pointed across the road like Moses. Go through there. This hole in the wall, this black cavernous shop with no sign. In there, you can do something. Inside, there was a mirrored ball on the ceiling, sending speckles of light around the wall, capturing old Levi jeans. Circle skirts with musical notes appliqued on them. Guitar-shaped mirrors, and there at the back, a proud jukebox blaring out the sounds of Little Richard's Tutti Frutti. And the Impalas singing Sorry. Billy Fury's Wondrous Place.
I found a place full of charm. Wondrous place.
On there, you can put your stuff. On the dance floor. I thought, dance floor? What dance floor? This place, if you had 10 people in it, it would be packed to suffocation. But yes, there was a floor, maybe 6 foot square.
Add 25% to your price and that's mine.
I could have exploded with joy, and before he ever wanted to change his mind, I was out of there. I did literally run all the way home. I couldn't wait to tell Vivian what I had found, a place, an environment that I felt I could truthfully run wild in. Strolling into that shop was so many rock and roll bands, Ringo Starr, David Bowie, Alice Cooper, Iggy Pop, the New York Dolls. Everyone loved this shop.
Standing in the rain, bullfrog, doing it again.
There was a kind of declaration of war against repression. Repression of those high street uniforms, clothes that didn't have an idea. And the success started to drive me mad. Echoes of that art school professor.
What you've got to do is learn how to fail magnificently, brilliantly, for it's better to be a flamboyant failure than any kind of benign success.
I was eating a bacon sandwich when a biker pulled over in front of me. On the back of his jacket was written, "Too fast to live, too young to die." I loved that somehow. It said so much to me. It felt dangerous, and suddenly, it became my new signature. Too far to live. Too young to die.
It's been a long time.
We needed to drive further into this world of negativity in fashion, a world that we felt would spell out this outlaw spirit. And as soon as Too Fast to Live, Too Young to Die became too successful, I closed it down. This time, we were going to make clothes that spelt one simple word that would have people rocking in the aisles, making love in the aisles. The one thing that people came to the King's Road to buy was simply sex. And we named the shop Sex. I ran across to this Polish cafe and said, boil me every goddamn chicken bone that you have at the end of any meal. I need them. I want to lace my clothes with chicken bones. I want with those chicken bones to spell out the words sex, rock. Wanted to make these clothes look like oilcloths that had been left under a car in a garage for months on end. I wanted them to look like animals, like dead rats, like things that were no longer clothes, but objects. I threw them into the yard and jumped up and down on them like a madman. Impossible for anyone to wear clothes. I bought yards of toilet chain that I wanted to lace these t-shirts with. There were people from the Rubber Duck Club. There were people who simply liked the sound of rubber rubbing against you in the rain. These people invited me and Vivian to join them on a boat in April. Sailing along the Thames, drinking champagne in the rain, was their kind of fun. Some of these people invited us to join them in their box at the Opera House, where they sat without rebuke in rubber, listening to Giacomo Puccini. I needed music for this new generation, and I needed a group. Young. Vitriolic, angry. There were creatures inhabiting my shop, street thieves themselves, with nowhere to go. I press ganged them into a group that I would call the Sex Pistols. Steve Jones was the leader at the time. Paul Cook was the drummer. So he said. And my shop assistant on Saturday, Glenn, would become the bass player. No one was very good at singing, and we needed to audition. We found someone, John Rotten. That's what we called him, at least, because he had green teeth. Rotten, dirty, green teeth.
Here's the latest trend. Wear it, faceless morons.
Another job that Vivian talked about. Oh, he's got such charisma. You'll love John. He's tall and he looked bloody brilliant in the clothes. But he never showed up. Instead, he became an agent provocateur and eventually was finally called Sid Vicious and did join the group.
We've reached a point halfway up the King's Road where a wall of punks about 50 strong is standing outside a shop confronting the Teds. The first scuffle started with one punk girl battling with a Ted girl.
These young, sexy assassins were ready to be dressed up to mess up. The Sex Pistols would have the look of music, music that would be cataclysmic, music that would be constantly on the verge of chaos and an anti-fashion that together would be a call to arms. Everyone could be a Sex Pistol. A jazz club was the perfect place to create this hell. The 100 Club on Oxford Street was ideal. At the age of 29, I became their fence. I remembered Fagin from Oliver Twist. I remembered the heroism of these creatures, of Charles Dickens. I understood exactly what I had to do. I was in love with their criminal minds, because there I thought they could create hell. And they did. The 100 Club on Oxford Street became a venue that would declare this new manifesto. They were anti-music, and we were all anti-business. In fact, the band and the music business, I made sure, would never get along. This was something that one had to do on purpose, because the Sex Pistols, as a product, never really existed. It was only an idea.
Majesty, the Queen, has asked me to form a new administration, and I have accepted. Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Where there is error, may we bring truth. Where there is doubt, may we bring faith. And where there is despair, may we bring hope. May we bring hope. May we bring hope.
The 80s was a gentrification of London. The underground world was dismantled and tarmacked over. People were taught to behave. There was nothing bomb-struck left in London by the dawn of the 80s. The 80s was the gentrification of London, the organisation of London. The general dislocation of its true underground to what was to be a globalised and corporate spirit. People were now going to be taught to behave. To have a job that was no longer a career was almost an impossibility. Everybody could create their own identity. Everybody could look like a girl who was looking like a boy who was looking like a girl. Or a boy who was looking like a girl who was looking like a boy. You could twist and turn, jump up and down. There were all kinds of looks being spawned, and King's Road never had it so good. A place where the most elegant, most refined, most sophisticated people came to wander and look and gaze in all these stores. It was a magical place in that regard. It was a place, of course, where you could buy laudanum. The apothecaries did a roaring trade. Laudanum was used to keep babies from screaming. Laudanum was used by Thomas Quincy for other purposes. Diary of an Opium Addict. Thomas de Quincey declared Oxford Street nothing more than a stony-hearted mother. Today, almost 150 years later, Oxford Street is the stony-hearted mother, unquestionably. A street that's turned into one gigantic, cold, selfish commodity. Bereft of ideas, it doesn't trade any longer in that way. To trade on Oxford Street is to trade with commodities. In 1950, in 1960, in 1970, in 1980, he once meant a rebel outlaw, someone who represented the look of the music, the rules of cool, to be young, sexy, assassins. To sing, I am an antichrist, I am an anarchist. Your future dream is a shopping scheme, but the fashion industry has bought and sold this look too many times. Having poured so much water on its wine, it's finally rendered it innocuous by putting an expensive price tag on it and plastering it with logos. Having been messed, abused, raped, and finally left for dead, rock and roll's look has run out of edge. Huh. So how strange must it be today for Mick Jagger to sit in Paris at Hedy Slimane's show for Dior Homme and watch his naive lookalikes march down the catwalk as if they'd been on stage, as if they'd been born on stage in what looked like his old clothes. What he used to wear back in the day, but now produced with the Dior label and matching price tags. Stranger still to see. Others like Riley Keough, the same face as her grandfather Elvis, plastered across magazines and billboards, modeling for Dior. It's nothing, nothing more than a reflection of pop culture's boredom with itself. And how do we think we can go on redressing the same corpse? Easy! Everyone today is their own curator who can pick and mix the icons they worship. Sid Vicious today, David Bowie tomorrow, Mark Bolan the day after. It's all part of a culture we can relate to and in effect now own. In this new world, shopping and entertainment have finally merged. And the satisfaction we get from dressing like a rock and roll rebel will last for as long as it is still fashionable. For everyone knows that once a look wanes, the passion it once stirred seems inexplicable. To understand this is to understand fashion and all those who create and consume it. We've come a long way since that day when I first listened to rock and roll in the 1950s. Born in London, grew up, studied, lived, worked, all in London. Starting out in Stoke Newington, where the bombs had struck, listening to the Ovaltinis on the radio with Grandma.
London by Tata, strange young town. London by Tata, brought me down. Starting out as a trainee wine taster, my first job there in Piccadilly at the dawn of the 60s. London by Tata. Sleeping in the cemetery on Harrow-on-the-Hill after being thrown out of art school. Trying desperately to drink coffee sitting on a coffin in Soho. Listening to the Isley Brothers, Francois Hardy, Little Richard and Elvis Presley booming out of a jukebox. London by Tata, roaming the streets, waiting to be discovered by someone. The Sex Pistols. The fetish clothes. Black, vinyl, bondage trousers. I've seen the underworld of London paved over in the 80s and 90s, a city that created the look of music and the sound of fashion. As we travel through the 21st century, we no longer appear on the street as peacocks strutting our stuff. We no longer need to wear our identity on our sleeve. We are living in a world of hackers, anonymous creatures, surfacing and surfing across the World Wide Web. It is the virtual world that's become our authentic world. The teddy boys in Tottenham or the fashion victims on the King's Road are here now on cyber streets. And in that world, the preteens are rumbling. Tribes are brewing.